The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JP Morgan Chase NA member FDIC 2024 JP Morgan Chase & Co.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Pushkin. Hey everyone, this is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for being here. It is with a heavy heart that I do this podcast today. By now, you have likely heard the news. On Friday, September 18th, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away after years of battling pancreatic cancer. She was 87. In 1993, she was just the second woman appointed to the Supreme Court. This court, mind you, has been around since 1789. For the first 180 years, justices were almost always white, male Protestants. Ginsburg's nomination, brought in by Bill Clinton, was historic. She served on the bench for 27 years. But over the past decade, she ascended to this kind of icon status. She was a pioneer on behalf of women's rights, a woman of peerless fortitude, even as the cancer metastasized. After graduating at the top of her class at Harvard Law School, she started litigation in the 1970s. Mind you, this was a time when law firms across this country seldom hired women outside of secretarial positions. In her memoir titled My Own Words, she wrote, "How lucky I was to be alive and a lawyer when, for the first time in U.S. history, it became possible to urge, successfully, before legislators and courts, the equal citizenship stature of women and men as a fundamental constitutional principle." Throughout her career, she pushed boundaries and broke barriers. In her final days of life, surrounded by family, in her home in Washington, D.C., she dictated a statement to her granddaughter, Clara. She said, "My most fervent wish is that I will not be replaced until a new president is installed." On her deathbed, she uttered those words. On her deathbed, she kept working. On her deathbed, she urged this political system to do the right thing in a year where all the wrong things seem to keep happening. I'll spare you the short list because you and I both know each pang is more painful than the last. 2020 continues to remind us there is no bottom. This could all get worse. And so far, it has. I'll be honest. On Friday night, I was unable to see a way forward. I was paralyzed, helpless, hopeless even. As I mindlessly doom-scrolled through my timeline on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, I could feel myself slowly descending further and further into this new dark space. New to me, anyway. You see, my mother is a lawyer, and since I was a young boy, I always felt chaos could be controlled. I believed in crisis management. I believed people could be reasoned with. I believed compassion could win out. In a crisis situation, I am the foolish person believing I can deliver a solution. Sometimes I even do. Oftentimes I fail. But this Friday, I was at a loss. I'm sure if you're listening to this show, I'm not alone in that feeling. As I slowly drifted off into sleep, I remember with one eye open, looking at this post from Gloria Steinem. Gloria worked tirelessly with Justice Ginsburg on behalf of women's rights, combating gender discrimination. In this post, Gloria wrote, "We each can honor Ruth Bader Ginsburg by asking ourselves, what would Ruth do?" I had no answer to what Ruth would do on Friday night. I didn't have an answer on Saturday either. But as I awoke today, I felt this uncanny sensation to answer Gloria's inquiry. The question, "What would Ruth do?" started playing like a refrain in my head. The question was no longer theoretical. It became real. What would Ruth do? To start, she would do what she did in her 87 years of life. She would combat a man who's vowed to fill a vacated seat on the Supreme Court without delay. She would use her voice to express the urgency of this moment, to remind us what really hangs in the balance this November. She would fight onward again and again and again, just as she did throughout her life, just as Gloria Steinem has throughout her life. So maybe the question isn't what Ruth would do, but what you will do, what I will do. I don't have all the answers to that question, but I know we have to start day by day, moment by moment. And so this talk you're about to hear with Gloria Steinem took place at the end of 2019. For those of you who've heard it before and reached out, I know it has served as refuge in these turbulent times. I know it has provided light inside this unfathomable darkness. In the show's 4-year history, this is a singular talk. I know that because strangers, irrespective of class, race, gender, geography, have reached out about this talk, about Gloria. Gloria's mission often aligned and coincided with Justice Ginsburg. They were friends and contemporaries. They fought fearlessly and vocally on behalf of women's rights, on behalf of gender equality, on behalf of you and I. At the end of Gloria's post on Friday, she wrote that Justice Ginsburg left us a clear and precious legacy. It's up to us to keep her spirit alive. What would Ruth do? What will you do? I guess we're about to find out. So, whoever you are, wherever you are, I hope this talk with Gloria provides you with as much comfort and inspiration as it did me. And may the legacy of Justice Ginsburg live on today, tomorrow, and the next through you and I both. Stay safe and be well.
as you can see. I at least got the books. Who knows if
I
read them?
I'm very impressed. Every author is totally knocked out that anybody buys their books or reads them, right?
How are you doing right now?
I'm doing okay because once I actually leave home, which of course takes some doing, you know, we all have kind of inertia about leaving home, and get out on the road, it's interesting because you talk to people and learn things that you didn't know. So it's interesting.
I have, I think, many things I don't know about you that I'd like to know. I want to start, if you don't mind, at the opening of this book. It's called My Life on the Road, and in it you wrote the following. This book is dedicated to Dr. John Sharp of London, who in 1957, a decade before physicians in England could legally perform an abortion for any reason other than the health of the woman, took the considerable risk of referring for an abortion a 22-year-old American on her way to India. Knowing only that she had broken an engagement at home to seek an unknown fate, he said, "You must promise me two things. First, you will not tell anyone my name. Second, you will do what you want with your life." Can we go back to you being 22, afraid to get a procedure that was outlawed in many places? Where are you at in that moment?
I was really quite desperate. I was also delusional because I thought if I went riding in Central Park or threw myself down the stairs, somehow that this would accomplish an abortion. I mean, you
didn't
know.
Didn't you do that?
No, I didn't. But the mythology was very much part of our lives. Remember that I am a product not even of the 60s, but of the 50s. I had left home. And right after college graduation, I was engaged to a very nice man who remained my friend the rest of his life. But I knew that it was really not the right thing for either one of us. And also, marriage was made to seem the end of life then because you assumed your husband's identity and it was as if that was the only decision you could make. So because I had a fellowship in India, I left early and worked as a waitress in London, waiting to get my visa. And it was there that I realized that I was pregnant and I didn't know what to do. I had this whole notion that if I went to Paris, somehow surely the French who were more liberal, you know, forgetting entirely that it was a Catholic country. Mm-hmm. So just narrowly and with a lot of desperation, and finding in the London equivalent of the Yellow Pages the name of this doctor who turned out to be a wonderful man, a generous, principled man who I had so promised that I wouldn't say his name that I didn't say his name for years. And when I was writing this book, I thought, all right, he cannot possibly be alive now. The laws have changed. I must thank him.
Mm. You picked him by random.
Yes, out of the phone book, right?
What do you make of that?
I don't know what to make of that. I mean, it was just luck or divine providence. But mainly, it was him as a principled, compassionate person.
Mm. I bring that passage up because it seems to me that 22 is a very precarious age. Ideas are not fully formed. Ideas of self are just coming together. A life hasn't exactly been built. You finish college and decide to go to India. Are you afraid at all?
No, because of the way I grew up, I don't know if I can explain this. The world outside of home was safer than the world inside home. Not because my parents were in any way not good people, they were. But my mother was not able to take care of herself, so our roles were reversed. I was looking after her. And my father, they had separated when I was about 10, and he was on the road all the time.
Right.
buying and selling jewelry, and, you know, he was a total wanderer.
And you went along with him?
Well, when I was a child, I did, yeah. So it always seemed to me that the world outside the house was safer than the world in the house. And that meant that I was not all that brave to be an adventurer. It felt safer.
Mm, it felt just natural.
Well, natural, I don't know. I mean, I was well aware that other people lived in a different way. But it seemed to me that as long as I had an opportunity to have an exchange with another human being, then I had an equal chance of understanding or being understood.
It seems to me that when you go to India, some probably dormant quality that is generosity was, poor verbiage here, but it sprung up. It seemed that it inspired you in many ways. Is that accurate?
Yes. I mean, this was an India that was only a decade or so after independence, and it was the object of the same kind of hope and optimism that South Africa would become later. Also, it happened that my mother and both of my grandmothers were theosophists, which is a philosophy that comes from India in many ways. So as a little girl, I'd been reading Lotus Leaves for the Young. You know, I mean, I had a kind of sense of connection to India, both from the past and its own very exciting democratic future.
Were you writing over there?
I was, because soon the $1,000 scholarship was out, and I began writing for Indian newspapers, writing essays and columns for Indian newspapers.
I'm very curious to see how those read now.
Yes, I should look at them and see.
You should.
You know, I think that the reason I was assigned was that people had a curiosity about what someone, an outsider, would see in India.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember writing one called Sorry Psychology, which was really about the difference that you feel as a female human being dressed in a sari. And you do feel different.
Mm.
I mean, it is a kind of a mobile dress that you can, you know, wear in many different ways, and that subjects you to the breezes. And, you know, it's very different from Western dress.
You've talked about how plans are in some ways, they sort of are linked to class and economics, that to even have a plan is usually
a measure of class.
Yeah.
I do think that that's something we don't think about usually, that the ability to plan ahead
right.
is a measure of class, because well-to-do families are perhaps planning for even generations forward.
Yes.
Whereas working people, poor people, are just planning for the next week.
Right.
Right.
I think you say plan for Saturday.
Yes.
Is what you've written.
Right.
I ask that because at 22 to 24, you're in India. You seem to be smart enough to get there, smart enough to write for an Indian newspaper. I wondered, were you making plans?
No, I was not. I mean, I was living an adventurous life before I did what I assumed one had to do, which was to marry and have children and lead one the life of the person you married.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that was the message of the 1950s.
But did you believe you had to do that?
I did. I just kept putting it off.
I'll get around to it.
Yeah, no, I just kept putting it off. And fortunately,
I do the same thing when washing my car.
Well, this is right. Okay.
They're equal, right? I'm embarrassed for making that joke. I should not quit.
It's okay.
No,
sorry.
It's inappropriate. I just made a joke about equality to Gloria Steinem in my car.
Laughter is always good, no matter what.
Okay, good.
Okay. Right. So, you know, I kept thinking that, but fortunately, what we might think of as the women's movement or feminism or consciousness or whatever you want to call it, both in this country and globally, sort of rose up. And suddenly I realized that not everyone has to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's okay to choose your own unique life. So that is a huge, huge gift.
Did you have a sense at that time in your 20s that you had been almost gifted this new start, because there weren't people who were going to perform this operation, and that they did radically change the trajectory of your life.
Yes, no, even at that time, absolutely, because I could not have gone forward with traveling to India, pursuing the fellowship. I don't know what would have happened to me exactly. I was working in an espresso bar as a waitress in order to make a living. I suppose I would have had to return home. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of unimaginable. But I was enormously relieved and felt free.
When you returned home, did you feel free coming back to America?
I did. But I was, by then, after 2 years in India, also greatly influenced, of course, by and changed, transformed by what I had seen. Because, you know, you suddenly realize that most people in the world do not live the way we live here. And the other thing was that when I came home and I was staying with my sister and my mother in Washington, I suddenly realized what I should have realized before, which is how segregated we are. Because I had grown accustomed to seeing many different hues of people in India, even though, of course, they also have a caste system and problems of division along color lines. But at least every day in the street, you know, you see, you know, many different folks. So when I came home and realized that where I was living, even though in the summertime I had been the only, when I was in college, I'd been teaching at a swimming pool in Washington where all the families around that neighborhood were Black and all the other lifeguards were Black. So I was the only white person. So I'd had that experience, which was a good experience.
Well, you've described that job as the most formative job that you've ever had.
Yeah, it's very helpful, I think, to be the only one. And they were very patient with me and, you know, very funny and humorous and so on.
Patient how?
Well, they just waited until I got over being self-conscious.
Uh-huh.
And then they taught me to play Bid Whist and Coon Can and when it was raining and, you know, and made jokes about the kind of racist teenage boys who would, you know, go by on their bikes and say something terrible. So I realized how segregated society was. But I think when I came home from India, it was the first time I got mad on my own behalf. How dare they tell me who my friends are and who my neighbors are? And I think that's quite healthy because otherwise the dialogue is too often assuming that white people have the power to include Black people and not the other way around.
Uh-huh.
So I think it was helpful that it wasn't a should or a do-good kind of impulse that I got mad on my own behalf. You know, nobody can tell me who my friends are going to be.
How did your anger manifest itself at that time?
I think, you know, I just started to realize that if you, especially when the women's movement got started, that if you're starting an organization or a group of any kind, it has to look like the group that you have in mind. You can't start with all white folks and then later on include the other, you know, which is already a mistake to say the other. But I was greatly helped because once the women's movement got started and I was writing for New York Magazine, so I could write about it there, but I couldn't get articles published about the women's movement elsewhere. Because it was just not seen as interesting or serious or, I mean, my favorite response was an editor who said, yes, if he could publish my article saying women were equal, but he would have to publish an article saying women were unequal right next to it in order to be objective. So I could see that it was going to be tough sledding.
Uh-huh.
And since I was getting a few invitations to speak because of the columns I was writing for New York Magazine, I realized that it was important to do, but I had never, ever, ever spoken in public in my life.
Right.
And I had devoted much of my life to not doing that. I mean, if...
You devoted much of your life to not doing that?
Yes, because, I mean, I went to a speech teacher when I was, you know, trying to do it. And she said, well, you've been two things in your life, a dancer and a writer, and both mean you don't want to talk.
Mm.
So I asked a friend of mine, a fearless friend of mine, who was running the first non-sexist multiracial childcare center in New York, if she would be interested in speaking together, and she was. So it was accidental but fortunate that we ended up doing this together, one white woman, one black woman going out and talking about the burgeoning, growing women's movement.
Is there something about that period? You know, you get that job at New York Magazine, I think in 1968. You're writing for a bunch of publications before that. A Miss comes around in 1972.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we started Miss Magazine then, yeah.
Do you think there's something in that time that people don't often talk about, that gets overlooked?
I do, and it comes out of my own experience, you know, speaking with Dorothy Pittman Hughes and Flo Kennedy and, you know, after Dorothy had a baby and wanted to stay home. You know, so it comes out of my personal experience. But then in one of the very early issues of Ms. Magazine, we published a Lewis Harris national poll on the women's movement, of women's opinions of the whole feminist movement and issues. And it turned out that 60-some percent of black women supported the women's movement and the basic issues of equality, and only 30-some percent of white women. Now, that was true then, and I think it's probably true now, because look at the last presidential election,
right,
in which some 96% of black women voted for Hillary Clinton, and 51% of white women voted for Donald Trump. Yet the women's movement is frequently, I mean, you see the phrase white feminism online, which to me is a contradiction in terms. If it's white, it's not feminism. So the image, I think, and to some extent it's true of the civil rights movement too, because I think the women, the black women in the civil rights movement, have not been given their proper emphasis.
Hmm. Part of the problem that I saw in revisiting that is how people like you, but especially you, were described in the press. And I want to play a clip here and revisit this for a moment, if you don't mind.
Now, guided by director Carl Charlson, here's a telescope profile of Gloria Steinem, her childhood, her work, and her friends.
Well, everybody's always asking me about her, you know. What kind of girl is she? She seems like a real bitch. Oh, she must be very aggressive and pushy. You know, they have these whole preconceived ideas of girl who gets to where Gloria is in life, what one has to do.
It makes me sad because of the bitch part. I mean, that really gets to me. I guess maybe it's worse than I think. So, I mean, I don't hear those comments, but what I've come to understand lately is it's not always personal. It is that all women come in for this kind of stuff, because I keep meeting women who I've heard all my life are bitchy and pushy and so on and so forth. I meet them and they're nice, compassionate people. It's if you don't play your role, you know, if you dare to aspire to something, then you get it automatically. But it's hard for me to remember that.
Then there are other people who say, well, Gloria's a star, not a writer. A lot of people say that. A lot of people talk about her star instinct, that she's always just slightly too far ahead in the avant-garde movement. There are people who just make simple fun, like Al Capp, who called her the Shirley Temple of the New Left.
Al Capp and David Susskind are two of the few people I can accept criticism from and not care, because I don't think they know what the hell they're talking about.
It's great that you have that clip. That's amazing.
What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's true that if you don't play your role, you know, I mean, anger, for instance, in women and in black men is viewed as more threatening than anger, which is fairly routine in white men. You can see that reaction to the same injustice, or if whatever it is that's making us angry, is judged differently in who it comes from. And, you know, it finally dawned on me that when I'm called a bitch, it took me a few years to realize that when I was called a bitch, I should just say thank you.
There's something else at play, which is the second criticism, which is that Gloria Steinem is less of a writer and more of a star. This tends to happen to anyone who becomes a figure in a movement. It happened to DeRay McKesson in the Black Lives Matter movement. It's happened to Noam Chomsky just as a public intellectual. I'm interested just at Gloria in the 70s and 80s when this is all happening. Did you feel the responsibility or the weight of being some sort of figure in this movement? Did that weigh at all?
Only in the sense that I should do my best not to appear by myself, you know, that I should always be part of a group, mm-hmm. which I think does make sense. Then also there was the other part of me that felt that I should be writing, you know, that I should be at home because I identify as a writer. So to the extent that I was not doing that, I felt that I was perhaps not doing the right thing. But in the moment, you make the best choices you can. And it was clear that it was important, especially in that period of time, and especially in places where there was not access to information about what the women's movement was, for me and Flo Kennedy or me and Dorothy Pittman Hughes to go out on the hustings and talk. Something happens when you're in a room physically with other people that can't happen on the printed page. And I don't think I ever would have learned that if it hadn't been for the movement and being forced out to speak. And it's true. I mean, I've asked my friendly neighborhood neurologist if it's true that you don't produce oxytocin, you know, which is the tendon befriend hormone that allows us to empathize with each other, not just to learn intellectually, which is very important, but also to sense what the other person is feeling. Mm. If you produce that on the from the page, much as I love books, or from the screen, and she said, no, you don't. So when male or female, when we're holding a baby, we're flooded with oxytocin. When we see somebody who has an accident, even if we don't know them, we have an impulse to help. Certainly, the human species could not have survived without oxytocin. Mm. And what I learned from going out to speak is how different it is to be with all five senses in a room together. I learned to have enormous faith in it.
I see a very interesting woman in that clip. I see someone trying to stay composed, a little bit nervous.
And smoking, how about that? Even though I wasn't inhaling. I guess I thought it was sophisticated to smoke.
You look sophisticated. I think you probably were sophisticated. But I also sense someone who is trying to do the right thing, but is being pulled from all different directions. And this happened throughout the 70s as Miss grew and you became more of a public figure. I could see in those appearances that you made that you were trying to do the right thing, and yet you had so many people constantly throwing punches. And I have to imagine at some point you felt some of those.
Yes, no, I definitely did. I mean, the most painful experience is being misunderstood by people who are your friends and allies. It's one thing to be accused by people who disagree with you. That's sometimes painful, but somewhat inevitable and makes sense. But especially in groups of people who have not been able to exercise their power before, there comes to be what is known in Australia, I think, as the tall poppy syndrome. Of what is known in the Black community as crabs in the basket. You know, one person, one climbs up and the other's pulled. That was more present in the earlier days of the movement. It's really not anymore. I think we've all realized there's a place for all of us, and that's the point. But at the time, there was a feeling of scarcity, I think, of attention. And so there was sometimes resentment from people you loved, you know, and so that was painful.
You know, it seemed clear in the documentary, In Her Own Words, I think it's called, on HBO. You talk about this time when your career is taking off and this movement is in, you know, full swing. Your mother is sick. She gets increasingly sick. And your sister is taking care of her for a majority of this time. You have this quote that I will say kind of broke my heart. You said, I distanced myself from my mother because I was so fearful of becoming her. How do you feel about her and how you were in that time now?
Yeah, no, I do have regrets. I mean, especially because we were living on our own for such a long period of time. So we kind of understood each other. And then she couldn't live on her own, but she lived with my sister, who had six children. And she managed to have a small job in a, you know, I mean, she was feeling better. But we didn't have the kind of intimacy that we had had when I was growing up. I was traveling, she was living with my sister. And I regret that. But even more than that, I regret that she couldn't live her own life because she had been a journalist, a pioneering, very early journalist when there were very few women. She'd actually been the managing editor of a newspaper in Toledo, which is very rare.
In the beginning, writing in a man's name.
Yes, right. See what great research you've done? I'm beginning to lose my memory, so I'm going to call you up.
Call me anytime.
Okay.
They'll give me my number after.
Okay. And most of all, I regret that she couldn't live her own life. Secondarily, I regret that I, because of our closeness, wasn't there enough before she died. And I've already outlived her.
But the fear of becoming her, it seems to me on paper that you were far distance away from becoming her. I mean, you were on the road. I mean, in this time, there's two decades here where you say that you never spent more than 8 days consecutively at home. It seems like you're very different from her.
Well, being mobile doesn't mean that you're different inside.
Right.
You know.
Maybe that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Where are those similarities?
She led a very different life in terms of travel or autonomy, which eluded her for, you know, most of her adult life. She really couldn't function on her own. So that's quite different. But internally, I think we were way more alike. And it's haunting to think who she could have been. Those are maybe the saddest words in English, what could have been. Mm. And I hope that even though a lot of us, me included, and perhaps you too, are living out the unlived lives of our parents or other people close to us, which is a worthy thing to do, that we arrive at a place where each person can live out their own unique talents. You know, and I used to say this to my mother, you know, because she would say how she wanted to go to New York and work as a journalist. And I would say, well, and also she fell in love with another man who was not my father, who was working in the newspaper office. And I would say to her, well, why didn't you, you know, marry the other man, go to New York, whatever it was that you felt you truly wanted to do. And she would say to me, but then you never would have been born. And I never had the courage to say, but you would have been born.
Right. In this case, maybe both of you are right.
Well, what is, you know, and we can move forward, I think, by being our own authentic, individual, unique selves and helping other people to be their own authentic, individual selves without group judgment. And I get huge pleasure out of that, I have to say. I mean, I realize that we're supposed to feel rewarded by money, and I'm certainly in favor of everybody having a nice place to live and food and dancing. You know, that's, I'm all for that. But when somebody comes up to me in the street and tells me that something I ever said or did helped them to do what they wanted to do, that is so much more rewarding than any amount of money I can think of.
I wouldn't have admitted the equality and inequality in my own life, even though I was continually discriminated against in journalism. Journalism, which allows women to write about women and black people to write about black people and keeps the editorial decisions in white male hands. I would not have admitted my own inequality, even though I had been refused apartments by landlords who would not rent to women and refused access to supposedly public places. I would not admit it even though I have been refused full participation in politics. Now, thanks to the spirit of equality in the air and to the work of many of my more foresighted sisters, I no longer accept society's judgment that my group is second class.
Was falling in love something you thought about? Or did in that time?
Oh, yes, absolutely. No, I mean, you know, I probably was a romance junkie. I mean, there's something about...
What does that mean for you?
Well, you know, you fall in love with somebody. There's this intense period of getting to know each other and exploring and so on. I mean, there's a reason I'm told why when you fall out of love, you crave chocolate because the epinephrine, whatever it is. That
right.
There's a word
there
for
is
it.
A
I've
term.
Forgotten.
I
yeah,
don't
right,
have it.
Right. Is present in both cases. There is a difference between romance and love.
Uh-huh.
And hopefully romance leads to love. But there is something infinitely exciting about really getting to know another person.
Did those partners at the time want you to be someone that you couldn't be?
Yes, in the beginning, you know, because they're all living in an era in which, you know, marriage was the be-all and end-all.
I guess I bring that up because a lot of the criticism of you at the time, which is mystifying to read from my perspective, especially in 2019, but it's that, how could you write about women and feminism when you do not have children and you are not married? That was a constant attack. It's still even lingering now, although it's much less amplified. Did that matter to you?
No, it really didn't, because it always seemed to me that feminism meant that you got to live the way that was right for you. And I would devoutly argue, you know, that women who are mothers are probably the least equally treated. I mean, some men are becoming equal fathers, but a lot are not. Actually, economically, at a minimum, we should be able to say, to assess what mothers or women who work in the home do at replacement level and make that tax deductible. Why not? You know, we could do that with a simple legislation. And yet that work, which is so indispensable, is not counted as work. So we need to advocate for each other. But I never was made to feel that I had to live in a way I was not. On the contrary, the movement let me understand that it was okay to live your own life and your own individual choices.
When you turned 50, there seemed to be a dramatic turning point in your life. In 1987, Miss closed, at least temporarily. And the movement, I wouldn't say slowed down, but I think it changed speeds.
Well, it didn't. It became a foundation, and then eventually it became
right.
published by the... I mean, it was continuously published, but yeah.
But personally for you, you've described that time as being particularly difficult. You felt some depression. It's hard to switch gears.
Well, that was actually less connected to the magazine than that I was really, really, really tired.
Naturally.
Seriously tired. And I did something I've never before or since done in my life, which is to fall in love with a man with whom I had nothing in common.
Really?
Yeah, right.
How'd you do that?
I was tired, and he was a great dancer. What can I say? and he...
Those two things seem contradictory. He was tired, no, but we danced,
no,
so it was okay.
But tired of, you know, work and not having any other life.
Right.
And he was funny. He was a great dancer. He also was successful in his field, so all I had to do was show up for dinner. I never had to worry about, you know, I mean, he took care of absolutely everything. And it was fun. It was educational, but it was, I mean, all of the other, not that there are so many, but the other men I loved are still my friends.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely all of them. But we were just too different. We, you know, we're not enemies, but we were just too different.
How did that affect you transitioning into your 50s?
I think I got depressed by it because I was so tired and aware, you know, that I had done something that wasn't true to who I was myself. So it did, you know, I must say that up to then, I thought that therapy was totally wonderful for other people, but maybe I would rather do something practical like learn to roller skate, you know?
I can't roller skate.
I mean, I had a Midwestern attitude towards therapy, I think. But at that point, I found also the other thing was that I had breast cancer for the first time, and that was shocking. So between those two things, I did kind of pause and say, you know, I want to wait and think and figure out what I'm doing with my life. I did.
Well, something you did do in the aftermath of that is write a book called Revolutions from Within. You did an interview in 1992 on NPR in which you said, women become ourselves again after 50. I believe you were quoting Carolyn Helber,
mm-hmm.
right? From her book, Writing a Woman's Life. Do you believe that? Do you feel like you became yourself after 50?
Well, I'm not trying to overgeneralize, but I do think that there's a way in which, maybe this is true somewhat for men too, but I think especially for girls and women, we are our own selves climbing trees and saying, I know what I want, I know what I think, and so on, up until we're about 10 or 11. Then the so-called feminine role, the gender role, comes down upon us, and it doesn't let up until we're about 50. So I do think there are ways in which the people we are after we're 50, 60, 70 more resemble the little girl who was climbing trees in the first place, because the central years of life are more influenced. Whether you are going along with the gender role or fighting the gender role, it's enmeshed with the gender role.
Mm.
And that's because those are the childbearing years and child-rearing years in which there is more social imperative to act in a certain way.
You know, you do this thing in your writing, and you even do it a little bit here, where you are very good at talking about women, other women, specifically friends.
You think I'm not talking about myself enough?
I think you admitted to it. In fact, the first draft of Revolutions from Within, you submitted, or you sent it to a friend, and your friend said, you're not in here.
Right. No, that's true. I was writing the book that I wanted to read, but I wasn't putting myself in, which you have to, because
you have to.
You have to give the reader a person.
Well, so I'm going to give you something here, because in one of my favorite chapters of this book, Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions, there's a chapter called In Praise of Women's Bodies. The year is 1981, and you're writing about your time at an old-fashioned spa in the company of 90 or so women. You then go on to praise some of these women, and I'd like to read a couple descriptions here, if you don't mind. You described one woman as a small, sturdy, young masseuse with strong hands who dreams of buying a portable massage table so that she can start a business of her own. There are two women friends who speak only Spanish, and whose arrival causes uncertainty among locker mates who speak no Spanish at all. From them, we soon learn that the language of bodies and gestures is universal. The third woman, A tough, witty criminal lawyer who wants to figure out how to use her legal talents to advance other women. In nudity, she relaxes enough to gift us with an epigram. Most men want their wives to have a jobette.
And there were one or more other...
There's many more.
Women, yeah, who had the stretch marks and the scars of cesarean birth.
Yes.
And I was so struck by that because the bravery of the scars that come from giving life as opposed to taking life in war, right?
How would you describe yourself?
Physically?
All of it, because you're capturing a bunch of different qualities in those passages. And that's the one thing I kind of wanted in here, is where Gloria fit into the equation.
Well, I'd never been with a group of nude women before. And of course, I was nude too. So you feel first exposed and then communal. You know, you feel literally your commonality. I think I love the feeling of being useful, you know, it's the fun of organizing. Well, we have this problem. If we did this and that, maybe that would help. It's just infinitely interesting. I get hooked on it. And I also love my idea of heaven as an editorial meeting because you're all sitting there, especially for magazines, you're kind of thinking of the current events and what you... And if it works, you come up with something collectively that you could not have come up with individually. And it's a real high. It's absolutely my idea of heaven.
You described still some other people in describing you.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, what can I say?
I think that's...
Ask me a question that will deliver what you have in mind.
No, I think it's your journalistic roots. I understand. I'm the same way. I started in journalism.
Well, I'm quite willing to answer anything you ask me.
Well, that's very kind of you. Okay, let's do it. You're married for the first time, 66, in 2000. How did that feel?
Shocking. I mean, I couldn't have done anything more dangerous than jump out of a plane by myself without a parachute because we hardly knew each other. But we had fallen in love, and he had been born in South Africa, and he had all kinds of difficulty with his legal status here. We had consulted with lawyers about how to help him with his legal status. It would have been possible to get an individual congressional bill passed through Congress, but it sounded quite unlikely. And they kept saying to us, the only real way that you're certain of is if you marry, because then it is the right of you as a citizen to marry. And, you know, he will have legal status and so on. And I thought, well, you know, we have spent 30, 40 years making the marriage laws equal. I wouldn't anymore lose my name, my credit rating, my legal domicile, and so on. And we were also about to go to the Cherokee National Reunion in Oklahoma because my friend Wilma Mankiller, I had often gone there and we were going there together. So I called up Wilma and I said, you know, I explained the situation and I said, you know, I'm thinking of getting married. What do you think? She said, well, I'll call you in the morning. She went out and sat under the stars and called me in the morning and said, yes, I think, you know, so we were married in a Cherokee ceremony. You know, who could resist that, walking around the fire? And, you know, I say dangerous because we didn't really know each other that well, but we were in love. We would have been together anyway. And it just seemed to make sense. And actually, it did, in the end, make a profound sense because he lived 100% in the present, absolutely in the present. You know, he was always rescuing animals on the roadside. And so, I mean, he was just totally in the present. And I live in the future when, of course, you can't live totally in the future with all five senses. So I learned from him, or at least I learned more from him to live in the present. And he, as it turned out, because he became very ill after a couple of years, he needed someone to accompany him on his journey out of life. So it was right in both ways, even though, you know, we could not have known that at the time.
What did that experience teach you about mortality?
I mean, of course, you know, we're all conscious of mortality and denying mortality, our own mortality, every minute. But what I remember most about it is that Wilma Mankiller, my friend, the chief of the Cherokee Nation, had almost died once herself in a very serious car accident, very serious. And she came to visit David in the hospital, and she told me that when she had this near-death experience, she imagined, she felt that she was flying through faster than any human being could fly, that she was full of warmth and a kind of worldview and just feeling, okay, now I know what life is about, and that she wanted to continue. But she had two little girls, so she realized she should turn back, and she turned back. And her description, which I'm not doing justice to, was, you know, longer and more fervent and unforgettable of that near-death experience, was something I'll never forget. And I so hope that David had that experience. And I so hope that I and you have that experience.
Well, that's very kind to offer that to me.
I can't offer it, but it...
Or suggest it for
yeah,
me.
It, because, you know, we're such a death-denying culture, and death, of course, is...
I'm not denying it, I'm just afraid of it.
You know, other cultures are not as death-denying as we are, so I think we don't think about it, and we sometimes, even physicians... who should know better, view death as a defeat instead of a normal, natural part of life that makes life more precious.
Do you fear it?
Well, I fear, I just don't want to be dying, lying there saying, but, other than that, I don't think I fear it. I mean, I just spent a weekend with a couple of women friends talking about what we individually want at the end of life, because we thought it was something, you know, that people don't talk about and we should talk about. It was fascinating.
I get the sense that there's still more for you to do.
Oh, yes. No, there's no shortage.
There's no shortage. And I want to bring this a little bit full circle, if we can. You know, going into 2020, we have done a wonderful job. We should both be proud of ourselves for not mentioning the person who runs this country. And I'm not going to still, but it's going to be a long, arduous year. Something that is happening right now is something you've been part of since 1970, which is the Equal Rights Amendment. In 1970, you gave a testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the ERA. And I have a quote here from it, if you don't mind. You said, during 12 years of working for a living, I have experienced much of the legal and social discrimination reserved for women in this country. I have been refused service in public restaurants, ordered out of public gathering places, and turned away from apartment rentals. Most important to me, I have been denied a society in which women are encouraged or even allowed to think of themselves as first-class citizens and responsible human beings. That was in 1970, it passed Congress but failed to gain ratification in the U.S. It's looking like, because of Virginia, which flipped to a Dem majority, that there will be 38 states that have ratified this. And it seems possible going into 2020. You have been part of this movement, this amendment, for 50 years? Do you think it's still deeply important right now?
Yes, you know, the problem with the Equal Rights Amendment, it always had two problems. One, people thought we already had it, and the other was that people didn't realize how much it could transform. So, you know, that has been its problem and continues to be its problem. But I do think now it might be possible. The remaining barrier is that it was the only constitutional amendment that was given a deadline. And now the House will have to vote, and the House Judiciary Committee has voted to remove the deadline, the limitation. So it's possible that it will be. It is crucial. After all, the Constitution was patterned after the Iroquois Confederacy, which included women and did not have slavery. I mean, we could at least, after all these years, finally be true to what we were imitating in terms of a real democracy. It wouldn't impact reproductive freedom necessarily, which is, I mean, I think we still have to demonstrate that bodily integrity, male and female, that our autonomy and independence begins with authority over our own physical selves. But it would be very, very important and very helpful in all kinds of ways.
Do you think it'll happen?
I don't know, because I don't know whether the deadline will be removed. I'll just explain some of the past problems and you'll understand why.
Your trepidation.
Yeah, well, for a long time, we didn't understand why it would get up to the last two votes, say, in Illinois, and different people each time would vote against it, and that would happen state by state. It took us a long time to understand that the insurance industry and the most frequent occupation of a state legislator was insurance agent, because the insurance industry was the last big, big, big industry that was not regulated federally. It was regulated state by state, right? They were the real opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment, because they would have to stop sex segregating their actuarial tables. What that means is that even now, frequently, a woman who doesn't smoke pays a higher premium than a man who does smoke, because she might live longer.
Mm.
Right. Okay. So they had to stop race segregating, but they haven't uniformly stopped sex segregating. And it took us a while to realize that that was the opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment.
I didn't want to go too into politics for a lot of reasons, but I feel I need to bring this up to you before we leave. The 2016 election seems to me to be a very crucial moment in American history. That feels like an understatement. And there's a quote you have that you've been saying for, I think, 30 years, and it's on the nature of hope. And you say, when people ask me why I still have hope and energy after all these years, I always say, because I travel. You seem to have a lot of hope in the basic decency of people across this country and outside of this country. Did 2016 at all shake your sense of hope?
Well, I don't think we can deny each other hope, because it is a form of planning, you know, so we
which is another good quote.
Yeah, we can't, you know, but it is important to remember that Trump, who I've never once called president, lost by 6 million votes, 3 for Hillary Clinton and 3 for other candidates. He only won because of the Electoral College, which is left over from the will of slave states that wanted extra power, even though many of their residents were slaves.
Yes, but you saw those people demonstrating. I mean, you heard his base. I agree with you that it's an outdated format, but I'm talking purely about the human spirit of people.
Yeah, no, well, I think that, I mean, if you look at the polls, it's some 30 or 40% of the people who support him and the majority who don't. We should have won last time in terms of one person, one vote, and now people are getting rid of state by state the Electoral College. I think it's very dangerous. It's like a big wake-up call there to see so much that is wrong with the country represented in the Oval Office. And, you know, I'm not downplaying the danger for a moment, but it is also true that we have the majority. And it is true, just in my wandering around the country, that I have never seen before in my life the degree of activism.
Mm.
That I see now. So he has made us woke big time, right?
Accidentally.
a very dangerous way of getting woke. And I'm not trying to predict what's going to happen. I think we each have to do the most we possibly can in order to get our democracy back, obviously, or not even back, move forward. I mean, we've never had a perfect democracy anyway. But the people who voted for him, the most, when asked why, the usual reason was because he is a successful businessman and therefore he'll be able to run the country. Uh-huh. Of course, those of us in New York who know him know he was absolutely not a successful businessman. He had gone bankrupt many times. Banks would no longer loan him money. That's how he got in trouble with Saudi Arabia and Russia and so on. Somebody figured out that if he had only invested the money he inherited at the going rate, he would be richer than now. Right? So
don't tell him that.
He's an accident of history in every way. But if we learn from this, if we learn to get rid of the Electoral College, if we learn to that if we don't vote, we don't exist, if we learn how profoundly racist and clinging to the old hierarchy at least a third of the country is, then will have been almost, I'm not sure, worth the learning.
I know you are always someone who's going to say, I'm just part of a movement. But I am curious, because you are 85. Maybe you think about this from time to time. But what do you want your legacy to be? Or what do you want to have left behind?
Oh, that's not up to me, I don't think. I mean, in a kind of general way, I would hope that people think I did my best and I tried to leave the world a little more just than it was when I showed up. But I don't think it's up to me. You know, I think I find inspiration or learning in the lives of people who came before me that probably they wouldn't have predicted. I will leave with trust.
You have a poem that you wrote 25 years ago. And you wrote, it's one of the very few poems I've ever written, from 2 decades ago when I was just beginning to discover the blessings of aging. I was going to read it, but perhaps you wouldn't mind reading it?
Okay. If I can see, wait a minute. Dear Goddess, I pray for the courage to walk naked at any age, to wear red and purple, to be unladylike, inappropriate, scandalous, and incorrect to the very end.
Do you think you've done that?
No, probably not.
I set you up so nicely. All you had to do was say yes.
No, I just mean that that in communal situations, where I, anyway, am not that conscious of the role I'm playing, but I think that basically I've done that, greatly aided by the fact that I've never had a job. Nobody can fire me. So, and that is a gift of freelancing. It makes it harder to pay the rent sometimes, but it's a gift. So I do think that because of that, I've been more able to be who I actually am and not worry about getting fired or what's going to happen the next day or the next. And that's a gift of my situation, a gift of my parents, a gift of the movement, a big gift.
Well, you may not have had a job, but I really do appreciate all the work you've done. So it's been an honor having you.
And I would like to say that you are, by far and away, the most careful and thoughtful and best prepared interviewer I've ever had. And now that I am losing my memory, I'm definitely calling you up.
We'll have to give you my number.
Okay.
Gloria Steinem, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Special thanks this week to Gloria Steinem. If you'd like to learn more about her, be sure to visit our show notes at www.talkeasypod.com. You can subscribe and listen to this podcast on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Google, wherever you do your listening. If you'd like to join our mailing list, drop me a line at sam@talkeasypod.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at TalkEasyPod. And of course, this show would not be possible without our incredible team. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Our associate producer is Nikki Spina. Our lead editor is Andre Lin. Assistant editors are David Harding, Eli Weiss, and Rena Zhang. Marketing by Patrice Lee. Our interns are Jules Rector and Grace Perkins. Music by Dylan Peck. Illustrations by Krishna Shenoy. Graphics by Ian Jones, Derek Gaberzak, and Ethan Seneca. And the show is produced by Caroline Reebok. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. Coming up, we have talks with Miranda July, Claudia Rankine, and Jenna Malone. Until then, rest in peace to the inimitable, incomparable Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And thank you for everything. We won't let you down. Stay safe, and so long.
The tradition of breaking tradition continues with the return of the Unconventional Awards from T-Mobile for Business at Mobile World Congress. This is an event that celebrates innovators whose bold actions took their industries to new places. If that sounds like you and you're a T-Mobile for Business customer, enter today. If you win, you'll be publicly honored among some of the most influential leaders in industry, and me, I'll be there too. Enter now at T-Mobile.com/unconventional awards. See you there.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.